and they seem just, entirely warranted, and in some way expected. He thought, 4 years gone warring, but back now on home ground, and I'm no better than a rank stranger here, a wandering pilgrim in my own place. Such is the price I'll pay for the past 4 years, firearms standing between me and everything I want. I believe I've made a mistake, he said. He turned to walk away. Go on up to the Shining Rocks and see would they have him. If not, take up Veezy's quest and walk to Texas, or parts even more ungoverned, if such existed. But there was no trail to follow, ahead of him just trees and snow and his own steps filling fast. He turned back to her and held out his empty hands again and said, if I knew where to go, I'd go there. It might have been timbre of voice, angle of profile, something, length of bone in his forearm, shape of knuckle bones under the skin of his hands, but Ada suddenly knew him, or thought she did. She lowered the shotgun to where it would but cut him off at the knees. She said his name, and he said yes. Then Ada had only to look at his drawn face to see not a madman, but Inman. He was blasted and ravaged, worn ragged and weary and thin, but he was nevertheless Inman, hunger's seal on his brow like a shadow over him, yearning for food, warmth, kindness. In the hollows of his eyes she could see that the depredations of the long war and the hard road home had left his mind scoured and his heart jailed within the bars of his ribs. Tears started in her eyes, but she blinked once, and they were gone. She lowered the muzzles toward the ground and put her hammer to rest. You come with me, she said. She pared the turkey's feet for handles and grabbed them up breast to breast, and when she did, their wings opened, and their heads flopped, and their long necks twined as if in strange inverted love. She walked off carrying the gun balanced over her shoulder, stock behind, the barrel held loosely in her upraised left hand. Inman followed, and he was so tired he did not even think to offer to take some of her load. They came curving down the slope through the chestnuts, and before long they could see the creek and its mossy boulders and the village far below them, smoke rising from the chimney of Ruby's hut. The smell of the smoke rose through the woods. As they walked, Ada talked to Inman in the voice she had heard Ruby use to speak to the horse when it was nervous. The words did not much matter. You could say anything, speculate in the most common way on the weather, or recite lines from the Ancient Mariner. It was all the same. All that was needed was a calming tone, the easement of a companion voice. Ada therefore talked of the first thing that came to mind. She counted off the features of the current scene they inhabited, herself in dark huntsman's clothes returning with game down wooded hills, the hutments of a village below with smoke rising, blue mountains all around. It lacks but fire on the ground and a few people to make it hunters in the snow, Ada said, and she talked on seamlessly, recollecting her viewing of that painting years ago with Monroe during their European travels. He had disliked its every feature, finding it too plain, too muted in its colors, lacking any reference to a world other than this. No Italian would have any interest in painting such a thing, had been Monroe's view. Ada, though, had been drawn to it, and she had circled around it for a time, but ultimately lacked courage to say how she felt, since her reasons for liking it were, point for point, identical to those Monroe used as support for his disapproval. Inman was too cloudy in his thinking to follow anything she said, other than that she spoke of Monroe as if he were dead, and that she seemed to have a clear destination in mind, and that some note in her voice said, right this minute, I know more than you do, and what I know is, everything might well be fine. The Far Side of Trouble. The hut was hot and bright from the leaping fire at the hearth, and with the door shut there was little sign to say if it was morning or night outside. Ruby had made coffee. Ada and Inman sat drinking it, so close to the fireside that the melted snow in their coats steamed around them. Nobody said much of anything, and the place seemed tiny with four people in it. Ruby hardly acknowledged Inman's existence, other than to dip a bowl of grits and set it on the ground beside him for breakfast. Stavrod rose into partial consciousness and moved his head from side to side. He opened his eyes, and they had a look of confusion and hurt in them. Then he lay still again. He doesn't know where he is, Ada said. How could he, Ruby said. Stavrod, his eyes closed, said to no one in particular, there was so much music back then. He put his head down and lapsed into sleep again. Ruby went and stood over him and stripped back her sleeve and put her wrist to his brow. "Clammy," she said, "that can be good or bad." Inman looked at the bowl of grits and could not decide whether to take it up or not. He set the coffee cup beside it. He tried to think what the next thing ought to be. But overwearied and warm from the fire, he could not keep his eyes open. His head bobbed and came back up, and then he had to work to bring his eyes into focus. There were so many things he wanted, but the first thing he needed was sleep. "That one looks played out," Ruby said. Ada folded a blanket and made him a pallet on the floor. She led him to it and tried to help him with his boot laces and with his coat, but he would have none of it. He stretched out and fell asleep fully clothed. Ada and Ruby stoked the fire and left the two men bedded down. While Inman and Starbrod slept, the snow fell and fell, and the women spent a cold and almost wordless hour collecting wood and cleaning out another of the cabins and cutting fir boughs to close up a small breach in the old bark shingles. In this one there were dead bugs all about the floor, dried-up blistered things. They crunched and popped underfoot. Hut-dweller bugs of some antique make. Ada swept them out the door with a cedar limb. In the floor clutter she found an old wooden beaker, or a bowl more like. Its shape was somewhat indeterminate. It had a wide crack where the wood had dried, and the crack was patched with beeswax, cured brittle and hard. She looked at the grain and thought dogwood. She pictured in her mind the making of the thing, and the use, and then the patching of it, and she decided the bowl might stand as marker for much that was lost. There was a little niche in the wall of the cabin, a shelf cut in the wood, and she set the bowl there as people in other parts of the world might feature icons or little carved animal totems. When the hut was clean and the roof patched, they propped the door in its place and built a hot fire in the hearth with any kind of wood they could find in the snow. While it burned, they made a deep bed of lapped hemlock boughs, and they spread it over with a quilt. Then they plucked and cleaned the birds, heaping the boughs into a big curl of bark peeled off a down chestnut trunk. Ada threw bark and all behind a tree down the creek, and it made an ugly pink and gray pile in the snow. Later, when the fire had burned down to a bed of coals, they put on green hickory limbs to smoke. They ran the turkey carcasses through with sharpened sticks and roasted them all day over a slow fire, watching the skins turn to umber. The hut was warm and dim, and it smelled of hickory smoke and turkey. When the wind blew, snow sifted through the patched place in the roof and fell about them and melted. For a long time they sat close to the fire together, and neither of them spoke, and they hardly moved, other than for Ruby on occasion to go out and throw more wood on the men's fire and to put her wrist to Stavrod's brow. When dark had begun settling in, Ruby sat by the fire, square to the world, her knees apart and her hands upon her knees. She had a blanket wrapped around her, and it stretched taut and flat as a bedsheet across her lap. She worked at a hickory twig with her knife until she had whittled it to a sharp point. She poked irritably at the turkeys with the stick until clear juice ran from under the stippled skin and fell spitting and sizzling in the coals. "What?" Ada said. Ruby said, "I was watching you in there this morning with him, and I've been thinking ever since."
"About him?" Ada asked.
"You."
"What about me?" Ada said.
"I've been trying to know what you're thinking, but I can't come to it. So I'll just say out plain what's on my mind. It's that we can do without him. You might think we can't, but we can. We're just starting. I've got a vision in my mind of how that cove needs to be, and I know what needs doing to get there. The crops and animals, land and buildings. It will take a long time, but I know how to get there. War or peace, there's not a thing we can't do ourselves."
"You don't need him."
Ada looked at the fire. She patted the back of Ruby's hand, where it rested, and then Ada picked it up off Ruby's knee and rubbed the palm of it hard with her thumb until she could feel the cords under the skin. She took off one of her rings and put it on Ruby's hand and tipped it down to the firelight to look at it, a big emerald set in white gold with smaller rubies around it, a Christmas gift some years ago from Monroe. Ada made motions to leave the ring where she had put it, but Ruby took it off and twisted it roughly back on Ada's finger.
"You don't need him," Ruby said.
"I know I don't need him," Ada said, "but I think I want him."
"Well, that's a whole different thing," Ruby said.
Ada paused, not knowing what to say further, but thinking furiously. Things that in her previous life were unimaginable suddenly seemed possible, and then they seemed necessary. She thought that Inman had been alone too long, an outlier, without the comfort of a human touch, a loving hand laid soft and warm on shoulder, back, leg, and herself the same as well. "What I'm certain I don't want," she finally said aloud, "is to find myself some day in a new century, an old bitter woman, looking back, wishing that right now I'd had more nerve." It was after dark when Inman awoke. The fire lay in its ashes and shed but a dim glow into the hut. There was no way to tell how far the night had progressed, and for a while he misremembered even where he was. It had been so long since he had slept in the same place twice that he had to lie still and try to reconstruct in his mind a sequence of days that would put him in a known bed. He sat up and broke sticks and threw them on the coals and blew on them until new flames blazed up and cast shadows on the walls. Only then was he able to say for sure what point of geography he occupied. Inman heard a sound of breath being drawn, a wet rattle. He twisted around and saw Stavrad on his bunk, his eyes open and black and shining in the light. Inman tried to remember who the man was. He had been told, but could not recollect. Stavrad worked his mouth, and it made clicking sounds. He looked at Inman and said, "Airy water?" Inman looked around and saw neither pail nor jug. He rose and rubbed his hands on his face and threw his hair. "I'll get you a drink," he said. He went to his pack sacks and took out his water bottle and shook it and found it empty. He put the pistol in his haversack and put the strap over his shoulder. "I'll be back directly," he said. He moved the door from the passway. Outside was black night, and snow came blowing in. Inman turned and said, "Where did they go?" Stavrad lay with his eyes closed. He made no effort toward reply other than two slight jerks of the forefinger and middle finger of one hand that lay outside his blanket. Inman stepped out and propped the door back in its place and stood and waited for his eyes to come to terms with the dark. There was the smell of cold and snow in the air like sheared metal, and the conflicting odors of wood smoke and wet creek stones. When he could see enough to walk, Inman made his way down to the water. The snow he walked through lay shank high on the ground. The creek looked black and bottomless and might as well have been running in a deep vein that cut to the world's core. He squatted and put the bottle in to fill, and the water against his hand and wrist felt warmer than the air. When he started back, he could see firelight glowing yellow from gaps in the chinking of the hut where he had slept, and also from another hut farther down the creek. He smelled meat cooking and was suddenly overtaken by a mighty hunger. Inman went back inside and raised Stavrad up and dribbled water in his mouth. Then Stavrad propped himself on his elbows, and with Inman holding the bottle, he drank until he choked and coughed, and then he drank some more. He held his head up, his mouth open, his neck stretched. His gullet worked to swallow. That attitude, and the way his hair stood up and his whiskers bristled, and the blind look in his eyes, put Inman in mind of a new-hatched nestling, the same frail, horrifying appetite to live. He had seen it before, and he had seen its opposite, the will to die. Men took wounds different ways. Inman had seen so many men shot in recent years that it seemed as normal to be shot as not, a natural condition of the world. He'd seen men shot in every part of the body there was to shoot, and he had seen every result of being shot that there was to have, from immediate death to screaming agony, to one man at Malvern Hill who had stood with blood dripping from his shattered right hand and laughed a great booming laugh, knowing that he would not die, but would thereafter be unable to pull a trigger. Inman could not tell what Stavrad's fate might be, neither from the look in his face, nor from the condition of his wound, which, upon inspection, Inman found to be dry and packed with spider web and root shavings. Stavrad was hot to the touch, but Inman had long since quit trying to forecast whether shot men would die or not. In his experience, great wounds sometimes healed, small sometimes festered. Any wound might heal on the skin side, but keep on burrowing inward to a man's core until it ate him up. The why of it, like much in life, offered little access to logic. Inman built the fire to a blaze, and when the hut was bright and warm, he left Stavrad asleep and went outside. He trod in his own tracks to the creek again, and cupped up water in his hand and dashed it in his face. He pulled a twig off a beech limb and frazzled the end of it with his thumbnail and brushed his teeth. Then he walked down to the other lighted hut. He stood outside and listened, but could hear no voices. The smell of roasted turkey filled the air. Inman said, "Hello?" He waited, and there was no response, and he said it again. Then he knocked on the door. Ruby edged it open about a hand wide and looked out. "Oh," she said, as if she might have been expecting somebody else. "I woke up," he said. "I don't know how long I was asleep. That man back there wanted water, and I gave him some." "You've slept 12 hours or better," Ruby said. She slid the door out of the way to let him in. Ada sat cross-legged on the ground before the fire, and as Inman entered, she looked up at him. The yellow light was on her face, and her dark hair was loose on her shoulders. Inman thought her about as handsome a sight as men are allowed to see, and he was momentarily taken aback by it. She looked so beautiful to him it made his cheekbones hurt. He pressed a knuckle beneath his eye. He did not know what to do with himself. No previous formula of etiquette seemed to apply, other than to take off his hat. There was little ceremony to stand on in an Indian hut in a snowstorm, at least none that he was privy to. He thought he might just as well go and sit beside her. But before he had any more than made up his mind and set his haversack in the corner, she rose and stepped close in front of him and did a thing he knew he would never forget. She reached behind him and put one palm on the small of his back. The other she pressed against his stomach, just above his pant waist. "You feel so thin between my hands," she said. Inman could think of no response that he would not later regret as inadequate. Ada took her hands away and said, "When did you last eat?" Inman counted back. 3 days, he said, "or four. Four, I think." "Well, then, you'll be hungry enough not to worry about the details of cookery," Ada said. Ruby had already torn the meat off the bones of one bird and had its carcass boiling in the big pot over the fire to make broth for Sabrad. So Ada sat Inman down by the hearth and handed him a plate of the pulled turkey to start nibbling on. Ruby knelt and tended the pot with great concentration. She skimmed the gray foam off the water with a spurtle she had whittled that afternoon out of a poplar limb, for lack of the dogwood she needed to do the job right. She flung the foam in the fire where it hissed away. While Inman ate the chunks of turkey, Ada worked at composing a real supper. She put dried apple rings in water, and while they soaked, she fried wedges of leftover grits in grease from a strip of fatback. When the grits were crisp and brown at the edges, she took them out and put the apples in the pan and stirred them around. She cooked cross-legged for a time, leaning forward to tend the food. Then she turned sideways and stretched one leg out straight before her and kept the other bent. Inman watched with great interest. He had not yet gotten used to her in breeches, and he found the poses they allowed her to take stirring in their freedom. The meal Ada arrived at was rich and brown, flavored with wood smoke and pork fat, and it was just the kind of food called for by the upcoming solstice of winter, food that offered consolation against short days and long nights. Inman fell to eating it like the starving man he was, but then he stopped and said, "Are you not having any?" "We dined some time ago," Ada said. Inman ate without talking. Before he was finished, Ruby judged that the turkey carcass had given the creek water about all it had to give in the way of sustenance. She dipped out enough to half fill the smaller pot. The broth had the life of the wild bird in it, and was rich and cloudy, the color of nut meats toasted in a dry pan. "I'll see if I can get him to take some of this," she said. She took the pot by its bail and went to the door. She stopped before she went out and said, "It's time to change the packing on that wound, and I'm going to sit with him some. So to say, I might be gone a while." After Ruby left, the hut seemed smaller, its walls pressing in. Neither of them could think of anything much to say. Momentarily, all the old strictures against a young woman and man being left alone in a house came rolling in and made them awkward. Ada told herself that Charleston, with its cadres of ancient aunts enforcing elaborate rituals of chaperonage, was perhaps some made-up place, with only a tangent relation to the world she now lived in, like Arcady or the Isle of Prospero. Inman, to fill the silence, began commenting favorably on the food, as if he were at a Sunday dinner, but he had hardly begun praising the turkey when he stopped and felt foolish. Then, immediately, longing of so many kinds welled up in him that he was afraid it would all come spilling out in a frightening mess of words if he didn't shut his mouth and find some better direction for his thoughts. He rose and went to his sack and pulled out the Bartram and showed it to Ada, as if it were evidence of something. It was scrolled up and tied with a bow knot of dirty string, and had been wet and dry and wet again for months now, and looked grimy and ancient enough to contain the aggregate knowledge of a lost civilization. He told her how it had helped sustain him on his journey, how he had read it many a night by the firelight of a lonesome bivouac. Ada was unfamiliar with it, and Inman described it to her as a book concerned with this very part of the world, and with everything that was important in it. He shared with her his view that the book stood nigh to holiness, and was of such richness that one might dip into it at random and read only one sentence, and yet be sure of finding instruction and delight. To prove his point, he pulled the end of the bow and let the limp, coverless book flap open. He put his finger to a sentence, which, as usual, began with the climbing of a mountain and went on for much of a page, and as he read it aloud, he could not wait to reach its period, for all it seemed to be about was sex, and it caused his voice to crack and threatened to flush his face. It was this: "Having gained its summit, we enjoyed a most enchanting view, a vast expanse of green meadows and strawberry fields, a meandering river gliding through, saluting in its various turnings the swelling green turfy knolls, embellished with parterres of flowers and fruitful strawberry beds, flocks of turkeys strolling about them, herds of deer prancing in the meads or bounding over the hills, companies of young, innocent Cherokee virgins, some busy gathering the rich, fragrant fruit, others having already filled their baskets, lay reclined under the shade of floriferous and fragrant native bowers of magnolia, azalea, philadelphus, perfumed calacanthus, sweet yellow jasmine, and cerulean glycine frutescens, disclosing their beauties to the fluttering breeze and bathing their limbs in the cool, fleeting streams, whilst other parties, more gay and libertine, were yet collecting strawberries or wantonly chasing their companions, tantalizing them, staining their lips and cheeks with the rich fruit." When he had finished, he sat silent. Ada said, "Is it all like that?" "Not hardly any of it," Inman said. What he wanted to do was recline on the hemlock bed with Ada beside him and hold her close, as Bartram apparently yearned to lie with the virgins under their bowers. But what Inman did was scroll up the book and set it in the niche of the wall with an old wooden cup. He began collecting the cookware. He stood with it stacked and shifting in his arms. "I'll go scour these out," he said. He went to the door and looked back. Ada sat without moving, staring into the coals. Inman went on down to the water, and he squatted and scrubbed each piece with sand dredged from the bed of the Black Creek. The snowfall had not eased up a jot. It came straight down, hard, and even the boulders in the creek had tall topknots of snow standing on them. Inman blew out clouds of breath through the flakes and tried to think what to do. It would take more than 12 hours' sleep and one big supper to set him right, but at least now he could row his thoughts up again. What he knew he most wanted was to disburden himself of solitude. He had become too proud of walking singular, of his oneness, his loneness. His stomach and back still held the press of Ada's palms, and as he squatted there in the dark of Cold Mountain, that loving touch seemed like the key to life on earth. Whatever words were in him that needed saying, they ranked as nothing to that laying on of hands. Inman re-entered the cabin with his mind set on going to Ada, and putting one hand to her neck and one to her waist and pulling her to him, and thereby making all his wishes clear. But when he put the door in its place, the warmth of the fire struck him, and his fingers knotted up. They were raw from the sand, stiff from the cold water, frozen in attitudes like the pinchers of blue crabs he had seen on his tour of duty along the coast. Nightmare creatures who waved ragged weapons toward all the world, even their own kind. He looked down at the plates and flatware, the pot and frying pan, and he saw they still had a white film of congealed grease on them, so his efforts had been wasted, and he might as well have stayed inside and put the cook pieces face down in the coals to burn clean. Ada looked up at him, and he watched her take two breaths, and then she looked away. He could guess from the set of her face that it had taken all the nerve she could draw up to touch him as she had, to take him between her hands. She could not previously have done a thing so intimate, he knew that. She had made her way to a place where an entirely other order prevailed from what she had always known. But he had been the one who penned those words in August, and now the burden was on him to find a way to say what he had to say. Inman set his load down and went to her. He sat behind her and rubbed his palms against each other and then against his thighs. He folded his arms and hugged his hands under them and held them tight against his sides. Then he reached around her and spread his hands to the fire and pressed the insides of his wrists and forearms against her shoulders. "Did you write me letters while I was in the hospital?" he said. "Several," she said. "Two during the summer and a brief note in the fall. But I did not know you were there until you were gone, so the first two letters went to Virginia." "They didn't find me there," he said. "Tell me what they were about." Ada gave summaries, though not precisely of the letters as they had been. She described them as they would be, could she revise them from her current perspective. It was an opportunity life seldom offers, to rewrite even a shard of the past, and so she made the most of it. In amended form, the letters were more satisfactory to both of them than would have been the originals, more revealing in the details of her life, more passionate in sensibility, more certain and direct in expression, altogether more. The note, though, she left unspoken. "I wish I'd gotten them," Inman said when she was done. He started to add that they'd have eased some bad days, but he did not want to talk about the hospital right that moment. He held his hands to the warm hearth and counted back the winters it had lain dark and cold. He said 26 years since the fire was kindled here. It gave them a topic. They sat for a while easy together and talked as people do in the ruins of the past, having the unavoidable feeling that we are a short time here, a long time gone. They imagined the last fire that had burned in the hearth, and they cast the players they imagined sitting before it. A Cherokee family, mother, father, children, an old granny woman. They gave them personalities unique to each one, tragic or comic, as fit the tale they were telling. Inman made one of the boys to be much like Swimmer, strange and mystic. It satisfied them to invent lives for the imagined family that were more whole by instinct than any they themselves could ever achieve with hard effort. In their story of the family, Ada and Inman gave them premonitions of the end of their world. And though it is true that every age considers the world to be in a precarious state, at the very edge of dark, nevertheless Ada and Inman doubted if, at any foretime in history, the sense of an ending was as justified as it had been then. Those people's fears had been fully realized. The wider world had found them, even hidden here, and had fallen on them with all its weight. When they finished, they sat quiet for a while and felt the uneasy feel of occupying space wherein other lives have unfolded and then disappeared. After a while, Inman told her how all the way home, all he could think was hoping she would have him, would marry him. He had kept it in his mind, and it rose up in his dreams. But now, he said, he couldn't ask her to bind herself to him, not to one disordered as he knew himself to be. "I'm ruined beyond repair is what I fear," he said. "And if so, in time, we'd both be wretched and bitter." Ada shifted and turned and looked at him over her shoulder. He had unbuttoned his collar in the warmth, and there was the white wound at his neck. Others, in the look of his face and in his eyes, which would not quite meet hers. She turned back around. What she thought was that cures of all sorts exist in the natural world. Its every nook and cranny apparently lay filled with physic and restorative to bind up rents from the outside. Even the most hidden root or web served some use. And there was spirit rising from within to knit sturdy scar over the backsides of wounds. Either way, though, you had to work at it, and they'd both fail you if you doubted them too much. She had gathered that from Ruby, at least. Finally, without looking at him, she said, "I know people can be mended. Not all, and some more immediately than others. But some can be, and I don't see why not you." "Why not me?" Inman said, as if to test the thought. He took his hands from where he held them to warm at the fire, and touched his fingertips to his face to see if they were still cold as the nub ends of icicles. He found them unexpectedly warm. They felt not at all like the parts of a weapon. He reached to Ada's dark hair, which lay loose on her back, and he gathered it into a thick bunch in his hand. He lifted it with one hand, and with the fingertips of the other, He brushed the hollow of her neck between the cords that ran down into her shoulders, the fine curls of hair. He leaned forward and touched his lips to the hollow of her neck. He let the hair fall back into place, and he kissed her on the crown of her head, and took in the remembered smell of her hair. He leaned back and pulled her against him, her waist into his stomach, her shoulders into his chest. She fit her head under his chin, and he could feel her weight settle into him. He held her tight, and words spilled out of him, without prior composition, and this time he made no effort to clamp his jaw and pinch them off. He told her about the first time he had looked on the back of her neck as she sat in the church pew, of the feeling that had never let go of him since. He talked to her of the great waste of years between then and now, a long time gone, and it was pointless, he said, to think how those years could have been put to better use, for he could hardly have put them to worse. There was no recovering them now. You could grieve endlessly for the loss of time and for the damage done therein, for the dead and for your own lost self. But what the wisdom of the ages says is that we do well not to grieve on and on. And those old ones knew a thing or two and had some truth to tell, Inman said, for you can grieve your heart out, and in the end you are still where you were. All your grief hasn't changed a thing. What you have lost will not be returned to you. It will always be lost. You're left with only your scars to mark the void. All you can choose to do is go on or not. But if you go on, it's knowing you carry your scars with you. Nevertheless, over all those wasted years, he had held in his mind the wish to kiss her there at the back of her neck, and now he had done it. There was a redemption of some kind, he believed, in such complete fulfillment of a desire so long deferred. Ada did not remember that Sunday in much particularity, one out of many. There was nothing she could add to his recollection of the day to make it into a shared memory, but she knew that what Inman had done in his talking was to reimburse her in his own way for the touch she had given him when he entered the cabin. She reached back and swept the hair from her shoulders and up from her neck, and she held it with her wrist against the back of her head. She tipped her head slightly forward. "Do that once more," she said. But before Inman could act, there was a sound at the door. By the time Ruby had it out of its frame and stuck her head in, Ada was sitting up again, and her hair was down on her shoulders. Ruby regarded the two, their awkwardness, and the oddity of him sitting behind her. "You want me to go back out and cough?" she said. Nobody said anything. Ruby closed the door and put the pot on the floor. She brushed the snow off her coat and beat her hat against her leg. "His fever's down some right now," Ruby said, "but that's not saying much. It goes up and down." Ruby looked at Inman. She said, "I cut some boughs and made up a more proper bed than just a pallet of blankets." She paused and then added, "Somebody can make use of it, I reckon." Ada picked up a stick of wood and poked at the fire and then set the stick in it to burn. "You go on," she said to Inman. "I know you're tired." Tired as he was, though, Inman had a hard time getting to sleep. Stavrod snored and muttered snatches of the chorus to an idiotic fiddle tune, which, as best Inman could tell, was no more than this: "The higher up the monkey climbed, the greater he showed his yata da da la da dee da." Inman had heard men say all kinds of things when they were submerged in the dark of a profound wound, everything from prayers to curses, but this took the prize for foolery. In the intervals of silence, Inman tried to decide which part of the evening he might dwell on most pleasurably: Ada's hand on his stomach, or her request just before Ruby opened the door. He was still trying to decide when he drifted off. Ada lay a long time awake, too, thinking any number of thoughts. That Inman looked so much older than 4 years ought to account for, so thin and grim and held within himself. And she thought momentarily that she ought to worry about losing her beauty, about having become brown and stringy and rough. And then she thought that you went on living one day after another, and in time you were somebody else, your previous self, only like a close relative, a sister or brother, with whom you shared a past, but a different person, a separate life. Certainly neither she nor Inman were the people they had been the last time they were together, and she believed maybe she liked them both better now. Ruby flounced in her bed and rolled over and settled down and then turned again. She sat up and puffed in frustration.
I can't get sleep, she said, and I know you're awake over there thinking love thoughts.
I'm awake, Ada said.
What's keeping me from sleeping is I'm thinking about what I'll do with him if he lives, Ruby said.
With Inman? Ada said, confused.
With Pap, Ruby said. A wound like that will be slow healing, and knowing him, he'll lay extra long abed. I can't figure what I'll do with him.
We'll take him home and care for him, Swat, Ada said. Hurt as he is, nobody will come looking for him. Not any time soon, and this war has to end some day.
I'm obliged, Ruby said.
You've never been obliged to anybody before, Ada said. I don't care to be the first. Just thank you will do.
That too, Ruby said.
She was quiet a while, and then Ruby said, Many a night when I was little, alone in that cabin, I wished I could take that fiddle of his up to the jump-off and pitch it and let the wind fly it away. In my mind, I'd just watch it go till it was just a speck, and then I'd think about the sweet sound it would make break into pieces on the river rocks way down below. The next day dawned gray and colder yet. The snow no longer spilled hard out of the sky in fat flakes. It came down soft and fine, like ground cornmeal falling from between millstones. They all slept late, and Inman took breakfast in the women's hut, turkey broth, with shreds of turkey in it. Then, later in the morning, Ada and Inman fed and watered the horse and went hunting together. They hoped to kill more birds, or, if they were extremely lucky, a deer. They walked up the hill and found nothing moving in the woods, not even animal tracks marking the deep snow. They climbed up through the chestnuts and into the firs and onto the ridge. They followed its spine, where it curved. There was still no game but a few chattering boomers high in the fir boughs. Even if you could hit one, it would make but a mouthful of gray meat, so they did not waste a shot. They came eventually to a flat rock cropped out at a ledge, and Inman brushed the snow off it, and they sat cross-legged facing each other, knees to knees, with the ground cloth Inman had in his pack tented over them, resting on the crowns of their heads. What light came through the weave of it was brown and dim. Inman took the walnuts out of the sack and cracked them open with a stone the size of his fist, and they picked out the meats and ate them. When they were done, he put his hands on Ada's shoulders and leaned forward and touched his forehead to hers. For a while, only the sounds of the snow striking the ground cloth broke the silence. But after a time, Ada began talking. She wanted to tell how she had come to be what she was. They were different people now. He needed to know that. She told of Monroe's death, the look on his face in the rain and the wet dogwood petals. She told Inman about deciding not to return to Charleston, about the summer, and all about Ruby, about weather and animals and plants and the things that she was starting to know, all the ways life takes shape. You could build your own life on the observation of it. She still missed Monroe more than she could say, and she told Inman many wonderful things about him, but she told as well one terrible thing, that he had tried to keep her a child, and that with little resistance from her, he had largely succeeded. "And there's something you need to know about Ruby," Ada said. "Whatever comes to pass between you and me, I want her to stay in Black Cove as long as she cares to. If she never leaves, I'll be glad, and if she does, I'll mourn her absence."
"Could she learn to put up with me around is the question," Inman said.
"I think she can," Ada said, "if you understand that she is not a servant nor a hired hand. She is my friend. She does not take orders, and she does not empty night jars other than her own." They left the rock and hunted on, going netherward into a damp swale rich with the odor of places where galax grows, descending through scattered clumps of twisted laurel to a thin creek. They walked around a blown-down hemlock stretched across the woods floor. The plate of roots stood as high in the air as the gable end of a house, and clenched in the roots, many feet above the ground, were stones larger than whiskey barrels. Down in that hollow, Ada found a stand of golden seal, the crowfoot leaves withered but identifiable where they stuck through the thinner snow on the lee side of a poplar so big through the trunk it would have taken five people holding hands in a circle to go around it. "Ruby needs golden seal for her father," Ada said. She knelt at the tree and grubbed at the plants with her hands. Inman stood and watched. The scene was a plain one, just a woman on her knees digging in the ground, a tall man standing and looking about, waiting. If not for the store cloth of their coats, it could have been any place in time at all.
so few markers to show any particular epoch. Ada knocked the dirt from the pale roots and put them in her pocket. It was in standing that she spotted the arrow in the poplar. Ada's eyes nearly skimmed right over it, marking it as a broken twig, for a part of the shaft remained, though not the fletching. The wood was half rotted away, but still bound to the head with tight windings of sinew, gray flint point, chipped in smooth scoops. As perfect in symmetry of shape as a handmade thing can be, it lay buried more than an inch into the tree, some of that from the growing of the tree around it in a welted scar. But enough remained exposed to see that the head was broad and long, not a little bird point. Ada aimed a finger at it to draw Inman's attention. "Deer arrow," Inman said, "or man-killer." He wet a thumb-tip on his tongue and ran it across the revealed portion of the cutting edge like one checking the hone on a pocket-knife. "It would cut meat yet," he said. During the late summer plowing and harrowing, Ada and Ruby had unburied any number of bird points and scrapers, but this seemed somehow different to her, as if yet partially alive because of its placement. Ada backed up and regarded it in perspective. Summing up much, it was yet such a little thing. A missed shot 100 years back, maybe more, long ago. Or not long, if one took the right view. Ada stepped to the tree and put a finger on the end of the shaft and wiggled it, firm. It would have been possible to frame the arrow as some relic, a piece of another world, and Ada did something like that. She saw it as an object already numbered among the things that were. But it did not seem entirely so to Inman. He said, "Someone went hungry," then wondered, was the missing due to want of skill, desperation, shift of wind, bad light? "You mark this spot in your mind," he said to Ada. And Inman went on to recommend that they revisit it throughout their lives, to check the advancement of rot along the arrow shaft, the growth of the green poplar wood around the flint point. He described a future scene, he and Ada bent, gray as ash, bringing children to the tree in some metallic future world, the dominant features of which he could not even imagine. By then the shaft would be gone, fallen away, and the poplar would be yet stouter, grown round to envelop the stone entirely, nothing visible but a lobed scar and bark. Inman could not imagine whose they would be, but the children will stand entranced and watch as the two old people cut into the soft poplar with knives and dig out a dipper full of new wood, and then, suddenly, the children will see the flint blade as if it had been conjured up. A little piece of art with a clear purpose is how Inman pictured it. And though Ada could not fully envision that distant time, she could imagine the amazement on little faces. "Indians," Ada said, caught up in Inman's story. "The old couple will just say, 'Indians.'" They returned to the village that afternoon without game. All they had to show for the outing was the golden seal and firewood. They dragged the wood behind them, and it carved bands and lines in the snow, big limbs from a chestnut and smaller ones from a cedar. They found Ruby sitting by Starbrod. He was to some extent awake, and seemed to know Ruby and Ada, but he was frightened of Inman. "Who's that big dark man?" he said. Inman went and squatted at Starbrod's side so as not to loom over him. He said, "I gave you water. I'm not after you." Starbrod said, "Well." Ruby wet a cloth and swabbed at his face, and he struggled against it like a child. She mashed pieces of the golden seal and packed it into the wounds, and she brewed other pieces into tea and made Starbrod drink it. When she was done, he fell immediately asleep. Ada looked at Inman, the tiredness in his face. She said, "I believe you ought to go do the same." "Just don't let me sleep past dark," Inman said. He went out, and while the door was open, Ada and Ruby could see snow behind him, streaking the air in its falling. They could hear the sounds of him breaking limbs, and in a minute the door opened again. He set an armload of chestnut wood down just inside, and then he left. They built the fire up and sat together for a long time with their backs against the cabin wall, a blanket around them. Ada said, "Tell me what we'll do next when warm weather comes. What things to put the place in order?" Ruby took up a stick and drew out a map in the dirt, Black Cove. She put in the road and the house and the barn, scratched up areas to show current fields, woodlots, the orchard. Then she talked, and her vision was one of plenty and how to get there. trade for a team of mules, reclaim the old fields from ragweed and sumac, establish new vegetable gardens, break a little more new ground, grow enough corn and wheat to suit their needs for bread, enlarge the orchard, build a proper can house, an apple house, years and years of work. But they would one day see the fields standing high in summer with crops, chickens pecking in the yard, cows grazing in the pasture, pigs foraging on the hillside mast, so many that they could have two bunches, bacon pigs, thin of leg and long of side, and ham pigs, close-coupled and stout, with their bellies swinging against the ground. Hams and bacon sides hanging thick in the smokehouse, a skillet good and greasy all the time on the stovetop. Apples heaped in the apple house, jar after jar of vegetables rowed on shelves in the can house. Plenty. "It'll be a sight to see," Ada said. Ruby rubbed her map away with her palm. They sat quiet, and after a while Ruby slumped and leaned her shoulder into Ada's and dozed off, tired from the effort of imagination. Ada sat and watched the fire and listened to its pop and hiss and later the brittle fall of its embers. She smelled the sweet wood smoke and thought that it would be a measure of one's success at attending to the details of the world if one could identify trees by the scent of their smoke. It would be a skill one might happily aspire to master. There were many worse things to know, things that did damage to others and eventually to oneself. When Ruby awoke, it was late in the afternoon, almost dark. She sat up and blinked her eyes and rubbed her face and yawned. She went to check on Stavrad. She touched his face and forehead, pulled back the covers, and looked at his wound. "His fever's back up," she said. "Night will be the crisis, I believe. He'll stay or go, but tonight will be the deciding of it. I'd better not leave him." Ada came over and put her wrist to Stavrad's forehead. She could feel no difference from earlier tests. She looked at Ruby, but Ruby would not look back. "I wouldn't feel right leaving him tonight," Ruby said. It was dark when Ada walked down the creek to the other hut. The snow fell in fine flakes. What lay on the ground was so deep she had to walk awkwardly, stepping high-kneed, even though she trod in earlier footsteps. The snow held whatever light came through the clouds, so that the earth seemed lit evenly from within, luminous as a mica lantern. She opened the door quietly and entered. Inman lay asleep, and he did not stir. The fire had burned low. Before it, Ada saw that his things were laid out to dry, like objects displayed in a museum, as if each one needed space around it to reveal its true meaning and be properly valued. His clothing, his boots, his hat, rucksack, haversack, cook gear, sheath knife, and the great ugly pistol with its attendant parts, ramrod and cap tin and nipple pick and cartridges, and the wadding powder and buckshot for the shotgun barrel. To be complete as a display, it needed but the Bartram taken down from its niche and laid alongside the pistol. A white printed card to label what one saw, the outlier, his kit. Ada took off her coat and put three cedar limbs on the fire and blew on the coals. Then she went to Inman and knelt beside him. He lay with his face to the wall. The bed of hemlock boughs smelled sharp and clean with the needles crushed under him. She touched his brow, smoothed back his hair, ran her fingertips across his eyelids, cheekbones, nose, lips, stubbled chin. She drew back the blanket and found that he had his shirt off, and she pressed her palms to the side of his neck, the tight new scar of his wound. She ran her hand to his shoulder top and gripped him tight and held him there. He woke slowly. He shifted in the bed and turned and looked at her and seemed to understand her intent, but then, apparently without willing it, his eyes closed and he slept again. The world was such an incredibly lonely place, and to lie down beside him, skin to skin, seemed the only cure. The wish to do it swept through Ada's mind. Then, like leaves stirring in the wind, something akin to panic shivered within her. But she put it away from her, and stood, and started undoing the waist button and long, strange row of fly buttons on her breeches. She discovered them to be a garment you cannot remove gracefully. The first leg came off fine, but then, in switching her weight from one foot to the other, she lost her balance, and had to crow-hop twice to get it back. She looked toward Inman, and found his eyes were open, watching her. She felt foolish, and wished she were in the dark instead of standing before the low yellow flames of the smoky cedar fire, or that she were wearing a gown which she could let fall in a smooth cascade around her, a pool at her feet which she would step away from. But here she stood, with Monroe's breeches still clenched around one leg. "Turn your back," she said. "Not for every gold dollar in the federal treasury," Inman said. She turned away from him, nervous and awkward. Then, when she was undressed, she held her clothes before her and half turned toward him. Inman sat up with a blanket around his waist. He had been living like a dead man, and this was life before him, an offering within his reach. He leaned forward and pulled the clothes from her hands and drew her to him. He put the flats of his palms on her thigh fronts, and then he moved his hands up her flanks and rested his forearms on her hip bones and touched his fingertips to the swale at the small of her back. He moved his fingers up and touched one by one the knobs of her backbone. He touched the insides of her arms, ran his hands down her sides until they rested on the flare of her hips. He bowed his forehead to the soft of her stomach. Then he kissed her there, and she smelled like hickory smoke. He pulled her against him and held her and held her. She put a hand to the back of his neck and pulled him harder, and then she pressed her white arms around him, as if forever. With the snow piling up outside, the warm, dry cabin hidden in its fold of the mountain felt like a safe haven indeed, though it had not been such for the people who had lived there. Soldiers had found them and made the cabin trailhead to a path of exile, loss, and death. But for a while that night, it was a place that held within its walls no pain, nor even a vague memory collection of pain. Later, Ada and Inman lay woven together on their bed of hemlock boughs. The old cabin was nearly dark, and the cedar limbs smoked in the hearth, and the hot resin smelled as if someone had walked through swinging a censer. The fire popped. Snow hissed and sighed as it fell. And then they did what lovers often do when they think the future stretches out endless before them, as bright as on the noon of creation day. They talked ceaselessly of the past, as if each must be caught up on the other's previous doings before they can move forward, paired. They talked through most of the night, as if charged by law with recounting in the greatest of detail their childhoods, their youths, and they both painted them as idols. Even the brutal, muggy heat of Charleston summers took on an element of drama in Ada's telling. When Inman reached the war years, though, he accounted for them in only the weak detail of a newspaper account, the names of the generals who had commanded him, the large movements of troops, the failure and success of various strategies, the frequent force of blind luck in determining which side prevailed. What he wanted Ada to know was that you could tell such things on and on, and yet no more get to the full truth of the war than you would get to the full truth of an old sow bear's life by following her sign through the woods. A claw mark on a bee tree and a great pone of greasy scat shot through with yellow berry seeds told only two brief and possibly misleading installments in the big black mystery of the bear itself. No man, not even if you went all the way up to Lee, could accurately describe more than one blunt forehand of the bear. Its hooked black claws, the plump cracked pads, the coarse and shiny hair cupped down over the paw ends. Inman figured he himself might only know something as fleeting as the smell of her breath. No one could know the entirety, any more than we can know the life of any animal, for they each inhabit a world that is their own and not ours. All Inman would reveal of a personal nature were little stories, like the time during winter camp of 62, when the mud and stick chimney of his hut caught fire, and the bark and moss roof fell burning onto him and his sleeping mates, and they ran whooping and laughing out into the cold in their underdrawers, and watched it burn, and threw snowballs at each other. And then, when the fire died down, they fed it with fence rails to keep warm through the night. Ada asked him if he had ever seen the great celebrated warriors, the allegedly godlike Lee, Grim Jackson, Gaudy Stewart, stolid Longstreet, or the lesser lights, tragic Pelham, pathetic Pickett. Inman had seen all except Pelham, but he told Ada he had nothing to say about them, neither the living ones nor the dead, nor did he care to comment upon the federal leaders, though he had seen some from a distance, and knew the rest by their acts. He wished to live a life where little interest could be found in one gang of despots launching attacks upon another. Nor did he want to enumerate further the acts he himself had committed, for he wanted some day, in a time when people weren't dying so much, to judge himself by another measure. "Then tell me of your long journey home," Ada said. Inman thought about it, but then he let himself imagine he had at last come out on the far side of trouble and had no wish to revisit it. So he told only how along the way he had watched the nights of the moon and counted them out to 28 and then started over, how he watched Orion climb higher up the slope of sky night by night, and how he had tried to walk with no hope and no fear, but had failed miserably, for he had done both. But how on the best days of walking he achieved some success in matching his thoughts to the weather, dark or bright, so as to attune with what freak of God's mind sent cloud or shine. Then he added, "I met a number of folks on the way. There was a goat woman that fed me, and she claimed it's a sign of God's mercy that he won't let us remember the reddest details of pain. He knows the parts we can't bear and won't let our minds render them again. In time, from disuse, they pale away. At least such was her thinking. God lays the unbearable on you and then takes some back." Ada begged to differ with a part of the goat woman's thoughts. She said, "I think you have to give God some help in forgetting. You have to work at not trying to call such thoughts up, for if you call hard enough, they'll come." When they had momentarily exhausted the past, they turned to the future. They talked of all kinds of prospective things. In Virginia, Inman had seen a sawmill, portable and water-powered. Even in the mountains, clapboard houses were overtaking log, so he thought that such a sawmill would be a fine thing to have. He could haul it to a man's land and set it up and saw out the material for a house from the man's own timber. There would be an economy in that, and a satisfaction for the man as well, for he could sit in his completed house and delight in all its parts coming right from his own land. Inman could take payment in cash, or lacking that, he could be paid in timber, which he could then mill and sell. He could borrow money from his family to buy the equipment. It was not a bad plan. Many a man had got rich on less. And there were other plans. They would order books on many topics, agriculture, art, botany, travel. They would take up musical instruments, fiddle and guitar, or perhaps the mandolin. Should Stavrod live, he could teach them. And Inman aspired to learn Greek. That'd be quite a thing to know. With it, he could continue the efforts of Bayliss. He told her the story of the man in the hospital, his lost leg, and the sheaf of papers he had left behind him at his sad passing. "It's not without some sense they call it a dead language," Inman said in conclusion. They talked on, and time was what they discussed. They detailed an imaginary marriage, the years passing happy and peaceful, Black Cove put in order to Ruby's specifications. Ada described the plans in detail, and all Inman wished to amend was the absence of goats, for he would like to keep a few. They agreed they neither gave two hoots now as to how marriages were normally conducted. They would do as they pleased, and run their lives by the roll of the seasons. In autumn, the apple trees would be bright and heavy with apples, and they would hunt birds together, since Ada had proved so successful with the turkeys. They would not hunt with the gaudy Italian piece of Monroe's, but with fine, simple shotguns they would order from England. In summer, they would catch trout with tackle from the same sporting country. They would grow old together, measuring time by the lifespans of a succession of speckled bird dogs. At some point, well past midlife, they might take up painting and get little tin field boxes of watercolors, likewise from England, go on country walks, and when they saw a scene that pleased them, stop and dip cups of water from a creek and form the lines and tints on paper for future reference, contest with each other to see which might more successfully render the scene. They could picture ships navigating the treacherous North Atlantic for some decades to bring them fine implements of diversion. Oh, the things they would do! They were both at such an age that they stood on a cusp. They could think in one part of their minds that their whole lives stretched out before them without boundary or limit. At the same time, another part guessed that youth was about over for them, and what lay ahead was another country entirely, wherein the possibilities narrowed down moment by moment. Spirits of Crows Dancing. By the morning of the third day in the village, the clouds broke open to clear sky, bright sun. The snow began to melt. It dropped in wads from the bent limbs of trees, and all day there was the sound of water running under the snow on the ground. That evening the moon rose full from behind the ridge, and its light fell so bright as to throw crisp shadows of tree trunks and tree limbs on the snow. The pearly night seemed not Day's opposite, but a new variant of it, a deputation. Ada and Inman lay under covers for some time, twined and talking, the fire low and the door to their hut open, letting a